Mrs. Thatcher. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, sir, I beg to move that this House has no confidence in Her Majesty's government. The timing of the motion, Mr. Speaker, arises from the government's inept handling of the results of the referendum on the Scotland and Wales Acts. When we thought it was a time for decision, the Prime Minister thought it was a time for talks. As he'd previously spurned them, we were not wholly convinced that the reasons he advanced represented the whole truth. And we were similarly sceptical when he expressed his willingness to consider modifications to the present Act, presumably by an amending bill, or a totally different measure. From his days as Home Secretary, we know that the Right Honourable, Honourable Gentleman takes what might be charitably described as a flexible view of constitutional niceties. But even he might find it difficult to arrange for major changes on a subject like this to pass through all their stages in the 3 working months at most which are left to this House. Any such changes must be for a new Parliament. The only decision the Prime Minister really took was to delay a decision. And for reasons which I find difficult to understand, Mr. Speaker, such momentous delays seem these days to be accompanied by a ministerial broadcast. The good government of the United Kingdom and its unity is a matter of supreme importance to this House wherever we may sit. The new proposals are not for a dying Parliament, but for a new one. Mr. Speaker, the essence of the motion this afternoon is that the government has failed the nation, that it's lost credibility, and that it is time for it to go. Yeah. Unless the Prime Minister should advance his customary explanation of failure, namely his political inheritance, may I point out that his and this government's inheritance was from a Labour government led by the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Highton. This Parliament was elected in October 1974. By then, Labour had been in office for 7 months. They'd plenty of time to assess the economic state of the country. The election of October 1974 gave them the opportunity to state it clearly. They did. The Chancellor claimed inflation was down to 8.4% on his chosen basis. Later, when it went soaring up, how did he explain it? Not by any talk about the previous Conservative government's policies. That excuse hadn't been invented. On BBC Radio 4 Analysis in October 1976, the Chancellor said, "I think it's fair to say that inflation went up much more after the October election than I or anyone else expected, because the trades unions didn't at the time observe the social contract as they'd defined it earlier in the year." Indeed, when the Chancellor was pressed, he stressed the point and went even further. "I think it's fair to say," he said, "that wage inflation was the main reason for the runaway inflation in the months that followed the October 1974 election." Nor was it only inflation that had been beaten by October 1974, according to the then government. The Chancellor said on the 24th of September, after 6 months in office, "I am certain we can get through the whole of next year with well under 1 million unemployed." Not only did he not get through 1975 with under 1 million unemployed, he did not get through 1976 or 1977 or 1978. So it's no good the Prime Minister now saying that the disasters since October 1974 were the fault of the Conservative government. In October 1974, the Labour government took full responsibility for the state of the economy. But then, of course, Mr. Speaker, Let us be fair to the previous Prime Minister. He was prepared to take responsibility. But let us take the Prime Minister's own objectives as the tests by which he should be judged. He set them out in the first censure debate, which took place in June 1976. His first objective was to overcome inflation. Apparently, the Chancellor of the Exchequer had not performed that feat by the time the last election took place. Be that as it may, the fact is that this government has been responsible for doubling the prices in the housewife's shopping basket. Now, far from being overcome, inflation is rising again and will rise for the coming months. Indeed, on the Healey basis, it is already into double figures. And it was on that basis that the Treasurer gave us the figure 13.3%. The Prime Minister's second objective was to make inroads into the unacceptably high level of unemployment and to reduce it by 1979. This was in 1976, to 3%. Today it is double that figure. On that too the Prime Minister has failed. And his third objective, to achieve a high output, high productivity, high wage economy based on full employment. But only a week or so ago, we had news of the worst level of manufacturing output this decade. And a few days ago, we had a chilling reminder that not only are our industrial competitors ahead of us in output, but they are pulling away from us at what seems an ever faster rate. For every extra unit of output from a worker in British industry over the last 5 years, our least efficient competitor, the Italians, produced 2, the Americans more than 3, the French 4.5, the Germans 5.5, and the Japanese more than 6. In the same world conditions as we face, their governments seem to be able to generate the conditions for success. This government has failed. Those were the Prime Minister's objectives. His strategy was the social contract, and then a new social contract, to enable us to proceed with confidence in the years ahead. That strategy has totally collapsed, as many of us thought it would, but we were regularly vilified for saying so. The fourth phase of that contract, the 5%, was never accepted by those for whom it was intended. It resulted in creating the very confrontation that the Prime Minister boasted he had replaced by cooperation. And the people witnessed the spectacle of a government abdicating its authority to strike committees. So the Prime Minister's objectives were not achieved, and his strategy failed. Had his dream of new economic strength come about, the Prime Minister said he would use it to strengthen our position abroad, to ensure a peaceful solution to world problems through the use of the United Nations, and to strengthen Europe's voice. And the reality, rarely in the post-war period can our standing in the world have been lower or our defences weaker. The international position is graver than at any time since the 1930s. The difference is that Britain is now a nation on the sidelines. In one diagnosis, however, I agree with the Prime Minister. Influence overseas depends on economic strength at home, and a nation which can't manage its own affairs properly is not in a position to give advice to those who can. Mr. Speaker, there are, I believe, 4 main things which have contributed to Britain's decline in the last 5 years. First, far too little attention has been given to wealth creation and far too much to wealth distribution. So what has to be done? Top of the list must be a policy of incentive tax cuts. There's widespread agreement on this. There has been for years. The trouble is the government just doesn't do it. The Chancellor of the Exchequer has sympathy with the tax position of management, but sympathy is as far as it goes. The Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, the government's resident example of congenial and civilized man, is much more expansive. In a television interview, he said, "The rate of tax on salaried talent is very high in this country. The putting of this right is a massive problem that will take a little time. I believe this to be a number one priority in the Chancellor's mind for future action. That's my own view. It ought to be. But nothing was done. Even the Prime Minister tells his colleagues, if you talk to people in the factories and in the clubs, they all want to pay less tax. But pronouncement is not followed by policy. And lack of that policy leads to a hemorrhage of talent in management and a resentment amongst the skilled. The Jeremiahs sometimes say that the ordinary people of this country have lost the will to work. But let them work in other countries where they're no longer frustrated by British tax rates, and they can outproduce and outsell our competitors. Vital as tax cuts are to restore management morale and that of the skilled worker, they're also needed to encourage the growth of small business. Because it's mainly from that sector that we shall get the new jobs, tomorrow's jobs, that we need for our young people. Now, no government can protect yesterday's jobs forever. It can postpone the day of reckoning, but it cannot escape it. It can ease the transition from one job to another. But this government tries to protect yesterday's jobs without facilitating the growth of new industries. That's a policy for penury and unemployment, in which the regions suffer most of all. For wealth creation, a different attitude to profits is also required. Profits are pitifully low, and as a result, several companies have announced cutbacks in investment plans, ICI and Hoover, for example. The alternative of borrowing to invest is precluded for many businesses by the continuing prohibitive interest rates, which are the consequences of this government's policies. All our hopes for better homes for families, for better schools for our children, for better pensions for retirement, for better health service, all of them depend for their fulfillment on our ability to create the wealth to pay for these things. Fail in that, and we fail in all the other things. The government has failed, and the social services of other nations have consequently overtaken ours. That, I believe, is the first reason for the decline. The second reason is that the government has concentrated far too much power in the hands of the centralized state and left too little with the individual citizen. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, if the government had assumed less power over communities and individuals, the remoter areas in the United Kingdom would have less reason to worry about the power coming from Westminster. Although socialism is about centralized planning and control, even some members of Her Majesty's government have from time to time begun to have doubts about the wisdom of the policy. A former distinguished member, the late Anthony Crossland, in a lecture in October 1975, said, "But we must take seriously the fears about the growth of state power, especially given the penchant of some socialists for the continual spawning of giant new institutions under centralized control." He continued, "We should not be in the business of creating giant leviathans manned by armies of bureaucrats." What a pity he and his colleagues did not take his advice. It was added to by the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, who said in Birmingham this year, "We have to acknowledge that the decentralized private sector has outperformed the old-fashioned concepts of centralized planning.
Yeah.
But of course, such wisdom marks him out as a man who the left must try to oust from his own constituency.
Yeah.
But his views are ours, and we believe they're in tune with the nation. Not, however, with the actions of this government. For centralization continues, and it even increases. For example, the Price Commission, with its investigatory powers, descends upon even the most successful companies to pronounce on their efficiency, having had no experience in that kind of business themselves. The Concordat demands more planning agreements between government and companies, yet another hindrance to the job of seeking new markets and producing the goods. In one industry alone, the chemical industry, plant worth millions of pounds, would be lying idle today if companies had based their investment on totally unreal market projections put forward by the government and trade unions. The Concordat also foreshadowed the direction by government of savings in pension and insurance funds, away from the object of providing for pensioners and insurance holders to the objects of industrial strategy. But if the object of that strategy is to back success, the companies concerned will have no difficulty in getting finance. If it's to back losers, it would be better for pensioners if their money were not invested that way. But perhaps the most debilitating and damaging aspect of their policy of increasing state power is that supporters of the government positively believe in taking a higher proportion of the national income away from the taxpayer and letting the government decide on how it should be spent. In no way have they been reticent about it. What the policy boils down to is this, that the state should take more tax from the citizen and provide him with his basic standard of living according to what the government decides he needs. That would leave the citizen only less essential things to be found from the pay packet, a sort of pocket money society policy. And these things are put forward in the name of social responsibility, social morality, social progress, and so on. What they forget is that we shall never have social responsibility unless we first have responsible individuals. And how does responsibility grow if decisions on personal property and savings are constantly transferred to the state? We shall never have social morality without having individuals of moral worth, and that cannot be attained except by exercising choice and not taking it away. We shall never get social progress except through the efforts of individuals with a sense of purpose. Part of the reason for our decline is that Britain now shows every sign of a destruction of individual and productive energy which is wholly exceptional on any comparison with those European states most like ourselves. Those are the first two reasons: insufficient attention to the creation of wealth and too much concentration on increasing state control. I believe that the third reason for our problems is this: that the balance between power and responsibility in the trade union movement needs to be restored. And so does the balance of obligations between the employer and the employee. I've dealt on the immediate measures needed before, and will not enlarge on them today. But I say this: because of the ties of the Labour Party with the trade union movement, because the trade union movement effectively controls the conferences and executive of the Labour Party, and because it provides some 90% of the finance of the Labour Party, I don't believe a Labour government will ever make the necessary changes. right honourable gentleman could have taken action with our support. He chose not to do so. He is the prisoner of his own history in this matter. The unions were his stepping stones to power, and they know it. So be it. Changes will have to be made by another government, and I believe they will have the overwhelming support of the people, including the majority of trade union members. On the economic side, we have to break through the prosperity barrier in manufacturing industry. We can only do so if, through good management, proper incentives and cooperation, we are able to cut restrictive practices and raise output per person. Mr. Speaker, if we'd spend half as much time on policies to raise output as we have on policies to increase pay, we should have a higher standard of work and hence a higher standard of living now. The truth is that in the countries of our main industrial competitors, union and government policies have combined to do far better for union members than is the case in Britain. The fourth point is one which pervades the whole life of the community: the rule of law. This government has shown insufficient support for the rule of law in this country. The most cogent example of that proposition came from the Lord President in 1977 when he said, "It does so happen to be the case that if the freedom of the people of this country, and especially the rights of trade unions, if those precious things in the past had been left to the good sense and fair-mindedness of judges, we would have precious few freedoms in this country." Some of us were so appalled at what the Lord President had said that we tackled the Prime Minister about it in the House of Commons. The Prime Minister said, "Frankly, I don't think he went far enough." They set the tone. Events of the winter produced the new phrase for the Attorney General: lawful intimidation. The Prime Minister and his ministers take that view of the law. It's not surprising that others will follow. And of course, it was not long before one of the trade union leaders did. He said, "My advice is to carry on picketing. I cannot see union members accepting the court decision. They will inevitably act in such numbers that the authorities will have to use football stadia for detention centres." That is the rule of the mob and not the rule of law. And it ought to be condemned by every institution and minister in the land. As it is, the people have identified the weakness far quicker than the government. Go anywhere in the country and the demand will be for two things: less tax and more law and order. The phrase "law and order" refers not only to vandalism and violence, although that's uppermost in many people's minds. It also refers to something else. It means that our citizens expect and are not getting an ordered or orderly society. They expect the rubbish to be cleared, the schools to be open, and the hospitals to be functioning, and they are not. They expect each man and woman to rise to his obligations in an ordinary and decent way. They expect bargains to be kept between trade unions and employers as well. And they expect ministers to support them in those views. In the recent closure of schools, the authorities did not support the law-abiding citizen or his children. It was the citizens who had to go to the courts when their children were denied access to the schools. It was the law which upheld the parents when they could not persuade the council or ministers to help. The Secretary of State for Education took the view, astonishing as it may seem, that the council had not failed to discharge their duty. The Right Honourable Lady has been prepared to pass new laws to close good schools. It's a pity she's not been as eager to use existing laws to keep present schools open. case there was a law to invoke, there are many cases now when the interests or livelihood of a person can be changed or taken away and there is no remedy at law whatsoever. That is the legacy of this government. After 5 years, it's not surprising that our people want the benefit of having a government which regards the maintenance of the rule of law as the foremost of its tasks. There we have the record and some of the reasons for failure. Each crisis, industrial or financial, has been met by short-term measures, but there's been no serious attempt to deal with the underlying problems. On the contrary, they are worse. Government has doubled prices, doubled dole queues, doubled debt, diminished our defences, and undermined public respect and confidence in the law. But I believe that this is not only a failure of policies, but of the whole philosophy on which they are based. The philosophy which elevates the state, dwarfs the individual, and enlarges the bureaucracy. Across the Western world, the tide is turning against it, and soon the same thing will happen here. I return, Mr. Speaker, to the occasion for the motion. It's a motion which arose out of a constitutional matter affecting the whole House. Honourable members from all sides made an eminently reasonable request to the Prime Minister that he should determine the matters outstanding from the referendum by the end of this month. He deliberately chose not to make a matching response, but to try to manipulate the situation for his own ends. He can have no grounds whatsoever for anger if others judge it for the manoeuvre that it was. Nor, in view of the government's conduct of parliamentary matters during the last 3 years, can he complain if his present action is dubbed characteristic. It's not unusual for minority governments to carry on for a considerable period of time as this one has. What condemns the Prime Minister now is the justified feeling that the substance of matters before the House takes second place to the survival of the government. That feeling is widespread, and it robs this government and the Prime Minister of authority, credibility, and dignity. The only way to renew the authority of parliamentary government is to seek a fresh mandate from the people and to seek it quickly. And we challenge the government to do so before this day is through.